What does the word friend mean to you? I'm Gillian Russell, and for me, well, it's someone who I enjoy hanging out with, who I care about, who I'm loyal to, who I laugh and cry with, and yes, it's someone I would probably share a pot of tea or a bottle of wine with as well. On today's Personal Best, we're asking just how important friendships are for our health, our happiness, and our well-being, and whether we actually need to pay much more attention to that part of our life. Psychologist Dr. Kirsty Miller is with me. Kirsty, I've been looking at the dictionary definition of a friend, and it's described as a person, not usually a relation or a lover, who feels mutual affection and regard for another. It's also described as someone who's not an enemy, which I thought was quite funny.
That's quite key, yeah.
Are you big on friends yourself?
Yes, I would say probably quality rather than quantity, which I think is actually a really key thing, and almost sort of picks up on what you were just saying there in terms of your definition. Is it's about having people that you can trust and you can rely on, and having that sort of reciprocal two-way relationship, shall we say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, and I think that's very important, isn't it, that you have people that you can rely on, but also that they feel the same about you.
Yes. Yeah, and that's kind of the nub of it. You've been looking into this whole idea of friendships for us. Why are friendships important for our health and our well-being?
They affect all aspects of our well-being, I would say. You can probably imagine some of the more obvious ones, especially in terms of our mental health. Obviously, having people you can rely on and people who care about you and people that just simply you enjoy spending time with can improve all aspects of our mental health. So improve our self-esteem, reduce depression, reduce anxiety, even reduce the burden of stress. And the interesting thing about this is that there's obviously a knock-on for our physical health as well. So to this extent, having relationships and having trusted friendships actually improves our physical health as well. You can maybe even imagine a situation yourself when you're out with the girls and you're having a laugh and you just feel a sense of release almost. You feel, oh, I've not laughed like that for ages. There's the release of all these feel-good hormones, all the endorphins. And partly it is just that psychological burden being lifted a wee bit. And, you know, as they say, a problem shared is a problem halved. So there is some truth in that, that just having these people who you feel you can share with, you know, be it positive or negative, that can actually lighten the load a little bit.
What impact can it have on us when we neglect that part of our life?
Basically, it just makes us more vulnerable. In terms of our mental health, you're more prone to things like depression. Also, interestingly enough, especially for older people, things like cognitive decline, basically your mental faculty sort of slowing down, and things like dementia as well. So obviously, when we're talking about older people, that's a very important factor that we have to take into account, is that having people around you and having these friendships is very important in terms of their psychological well-being, both in terms of how they feel themselves, but also in terms of trying to stave off the consequences of ageing.
Well, one organisation that recognises the importance of friendship for our health and our happiness is Befrienders Highland. Richard Forbes has been finding out how they help people who are lonely and isolated.
When you're down in trouble,
my name's Susan, I'm the Executive Director at Befrienders Highland.
And Susan, is isolation becoming more common?
I think it is more common. People tend to move away from their families and friends to go on to study or to work, and there are fewer social groups and gatherings, fewer opportunities for night schools and reduced bus services and community spaces for people to collect in. So the natural social contacts people would have had have reduced.
And what's the most common reason that people are referred to your service, Alison?
Generally due to their mental ill health, and as a result of their mental ill health, they've maybe found themselves isolated or lonely as a result of that. It's still stigmatised at the moment, even though there's so much work going on to make it better. So people still feel that they aren't able to talk to maybe their friends and family about it, and therefore become more isolated in their own communities. Probably the biggest group we deal with is the 40 to 65 age group, but all age groups are represented throughout our service.
Now, you two are one of the friendships that's started through Befrienders Highland. Cara, can you tell me what life was like before you came to the project?
Very boring, sitting in a house with four walls around you, because I wasn't working, because I have epilepsy.
And that had been the situation for a while. What was it made you think, I actually want to help with this?
It was my social worker that came back with it, because I'd never heard of Befrienders. So my social worker came back and she said, oh, there's a group called Befrienders, would you be willing to give them a go? I had to kind of think about it a bit, I must admit. And when they gave me the age gap between myself and Amy, I was kind of, I'm not quite sure about this, but we'll give it a go, see how it goes.
And Amy, what is that age gap?
It's like 20 years or something. Yeah. I think we're quite special, actually, because we're matched regardless of our age. We're matched on our interests and we get on so well. I think the first kind of couple of meetings, it took us a little while to get to know each other and stuff. But now we've been friends for a year,
yeah,
almost.
I know.
And honestly, I couldn't ask for better.
Do you think it's made you more open-minded about who your circle of friends might be? You were saying at first glance you wouldn't have thought of someone like Cara being a friend.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a reminder of the importance that people are closed doors. You have no idea what's going on inside somebody else's mind, and all you get is what they tell you. So I think it is very important to be mindful that you have no idea what anyone else is going through.
What difference has Amy's friendship made to your life?
At least I'm getting out. I'm meeting somebody during the week. You know, you're guaranteed to get out and meet at least one person, you know, maybe just for a coffee and a chat, but a couple of hours, and yeah.
And do you have any words for the rest of us as to how we could all be a bit more friendly towards each other?
Maybe don't make snap judgment on people, is one I would definitely say, because I get that, or I still get that a lot of the time, because I shake due to the epilepsy. People instantly think that I'm either drinking or on drugs. Don't judge me. If you don't know me, don't judge me.
Susan, there's befriending projects similar to this across Scotland. Why should people consider volunteering to help?
I think it's about making a difference to someone's life, and you can't really believe that just giving an hour a week of your time makes such a difference, or just going for a coffee with someone, or just accepting somebody for who they are and offering them friendship makes such a difference. But it really does. I would say if you're a kind person who has some time to spare, even just a small amount of time, actually befriending is a really good way of giving something back to the community and making an enormous difference to somebody's life. Maybe an hour of your time, but for that person it can make a world of difference. You've got a friend.
Kirsty, whether we struggle to make friends in the first place or just have trouble keeping up with the ones we've got, what are the kind of lifestyle pressures that prevent us from maybe dedicating as much time as we'd like to friendships?
The key thing is really lack of time, isn't it? And the main drains on our time, I suppose, would probably be our work lives and also our family lives. Not necessarily that that's a negative drain, but just in terms of it takes a lot of time. And sometimes it is just having that awareness. Sometimes we're not even hugely aware that we're doing it. It's just the case that you suddenly realise, oh my goodness, a few weeks have gone past and I've not called that friend, or I've not picked up with whoever. So sometimes it is just taking that moment and thinking, do I need to just take that half an hour to myself and maybe pick up the phone? Or even better, nip over to your friend's house for a quick cup of tea, you know, take a cake, take whatever, because that face-to-face contact as well does do you no end of good. And it's so easy for us to say, oh, we've just not got time. But ultimately you think, do we have time for a 10-minute cup of tea, a 15-minute cup of tea?
So it's prioritising it like we might try and
exactly.
Do with our exercise or our nutrition or our sleep. It's putting it up there alongside other priorities.
Exactly. Mm. And the thing is that having contact with people, the beating isolation almost, that is actually a public health concern now. There are campaigners in America, researchers in America, who are trying to get the government to list that at the same level as things like obesity, smoking, And actually the effects of it can be as bad as smoking and obesity. It can be as detrimental for your health and actually your mortality. So you're actually at increased risk of death if you are lacking these people from your life. So it really is a public health concern. So it's something that we have to try and take responsibility for as well and think, yes, it's as important as making time to go to the gym.
You mentioned face-to-face contact there. I think that's interesting because thinking about technology and how much it's taken over our lives and social media and so on, I wonder whether we're getting better at making and keeping friends because we've got lots of technology, the world has become a smaller place, it's easier in some ways to keep in contact, or whether that can be detrimental because technology, and I think of social media as well, can create a false sense of friendship because your Facebook friends, for example, are not necessarily real friends in the traditional sense of the word.
It's funny because social media is a bit of a mixed one. As you'll probably know, if you've been hearing any of the research coming out about it, sometimes we hear that actually it can be beneficial, and then sometimes we hear, and more often than not I think we hear, that it is actually quite negative for us. And it can certainly potentially be a drain on our time, and gets back to what we were saying about making that time for people, that you've got to be careful that you don't spend all your time on social media, for example, at the detriment of your face-to-face contacts.
So make time in the real world, really.
Yes, yes. And I think that's something that we all have to be very mindful of, is that, yes, having contact on social media or even texting or whatever, it does feel like we're sort of keeping up to date. And in the absence of being able to see people face-to-face, that's actually quite good. So it's almost a matter of degree that if you have people across the world, social media is actually quite good because it is a way of maintaining that contact. But there really isn't any replacement for that face-to-face contact.
Well, I'm sure lots of us regard our friends as being people who we're kind of on the same wavelength as. But what do we actually mean by that? And just what's the science behind it?
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me.
I'm Carolyn Parkinson. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology and the Brain Research Institute at the University of California, Los Angeles. The idea that birds of a feather flock together is by no means a new notion. It goes back many hundreds of years. And time and again, we've seen that people tend to be surrounded by others who are like them in terms of a whole range of factors, things like age and gender. But you might have the sense that your friends aren't just people who fall into the same demographic categories as you do. Same age, check, same gender, check, and so on. You might have the sense that your friends are people who you sort of click with, who see things like you do, who have a similar perspective on the world to your own. And so in this study, we wanted to use neuroimaging, fMRI, to look under the hood at what's going on in people's brains when they take in the world around them. And in particular, we wanted to test if the brains of friends and people closer together in their real-world social networks would process the world around them more similarly. So my colleagues and I, Talia Wheatley and Adam Kleinbaum at Dartmouth College, began by mapping out the social network of an entire graduate school, about 300 students. So we asked every single student to tell us who their friends were. And that way, for everyone in the school, we know which people are their friends, which are friends of their friends, and which are farther removed from them in social ties. And then we had as many of these people as possible come into the lab to do an fMRI study where they watched a collection of film clips while we measured how their brains responded. And now we can divide each person's brain up into smaller regions based on the underlying anatomy and look at activity within each region of the brain and see how it rises and falls over time as they watch the videos. And this allows us to systematically compare neural responses across people. So, for example, if you and I were watching comedy and we both found the same moments in it funny, our responses in regions of the brain that process reward would sync up more with each other than they would with someone who didn't detect or appreciate the humorous moments that had resonated with us. And so for every pair of people in the study, we can test how synchronized responses were in different brain regions. And remember, all of these people are members of that social network we had mapped out. So for every person who did the fMRI study, we know which of the other participants are their friends, which are friends of their friends, and so on. And now we can test how much people's neural similarity to what they're seeing is related to how close they are to one another in the social network. And what we find is that friends' brains responded exceptionally similarly to what they saw. And the similarity decreased with distance in the network, so friends were more similar than friends of friends, who were more similar than people farther apart in the network. And what's more, we could even train a machine learning algorithm to tell us how far apart two people were in the social network based on their brain activity. And then when we gave this model new data from people it hadn't seen before, it could predict if these people were friends, friends of friends, or further apart in the network, just based on their brain activity. And some of the regions where these results were most pronounced determined things like how we allocate our attention, how we interpret situations, and our emotional responses. So these results suggest that we're exceptionally similar to our friends in how we attend to, emotionally respond to, and interpret the world around us. So it seems that friends process the world in an exceptionally similar way. But given that the study was cross-sectional, so it measured brain responses and friendship at about the same time, we can't ascertain if these results arise because people who already see and think about the world similarly become friends with one another, or friends become more similar to one another over time because of shared experiences and influence. So we're currently doing work where we can scan people before meeting each other and follow them over time so that we can discern which way the causal arrow is pointing here. Do people who are already similar become friends, or do friends grow more similar over time in how they process the world?
You got a friend in me.
Well, Kirsty, the idea that we have friends who are similar to us, I wonder, does that extend to the people we might mix with in the wider community?
Yes, I think so. I think we tend to be drawn to people that we have things in common with. That's natural. It's useful for us, you know, if you're a new mom, for example, it's great to have that little group or little circle or even just a few people who are in a similar position because they can relate to you in ways that maybe people who aren't mums can't, you know. So again, there's a lot of this feeling of working together and supporting each other and often having a shared goal. And again, that is very positive for our well-being. But there's also practical benefits as well of having this sense of community. It means that we know that we have support if we need it, both in terms of emotional support, but practical support as well. So if you need someone to maybe help give you a lift somewhere, or if you break your leg, you know, they can pop in and bring you your shopping or whatever. Just things on that kind of level as well. Just sort of knowing that there are people there if you need them is extremely beneficial.
Well, just picking up on that, I mean, I imagine when it comes to making friends, most of us would tend to gravitate towards people like ourselves, as you've said. But as Angelica Love from Oxford University explains, a bit of diversity in friendship can go a long, long way.
And I never thought I'd feel this way.
If we surround ourselves purely with people who are like us, we have access to a far lower range of viewpoints and life experiences. And whilst that may help us establish our own views and be confident in our own views, it might also lead us to be overly confident in how we see the world, to be hardened in our views, and in particular also to be so biased in favour of people like ourselves that we may ultimately treat people who are different from us in a way that is harmful and in a way that is prejudice-driven. And so by surrounding ourselves with a wider variety of people, people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, with different political views, we ultimately can foster relationships that help us develop our own empathy and that help us feel less anxious and less threatened around people who are different from us.
And so that can make you feel a more positive attitude towards these groups?
Yes, absolutely. If you have positive experiences, in particular friendship with people who are different from you, and importantly, you are aware of your own social background and of your friend's different social background during those interactions, that not only changes how you feel about that individual friend, but it can actually change how you feel and think about and how you behave towards people of that social background of your friend more widely.
And once you've challenged one preconception, does that mean you're more open to others in general?
Yeah, so this is a really fascinating and relatively novel area of social psychological research. The experiences we have with one particular group, what we call an out-group, people different from yourself, actually changes not only how you feel about that group, but about other groups as well. So we have this fascinating and really, really effective ripple effect of contact, to the extent that one experience can help you reevaluate your own views and ultimately maybe encourage you to seek out further contact experiences, but also more generally to feel less threatened and less anxious about other groups and to trust them more, feel greater empathy and generally feel more positively about other groups that you haven't yet met.
And the research shows that indirect contact can also have an effect. So if it's actually one of your close friends who changes their views, then that can have a knock-on effect to you.
Yes, I am particularly fascinated by this effect. We call it the extended contact effect. And as you said, it's not just your own personal experiences that change your attitudes, but also the experiences of people around you. And this is a particularly important finding for communities where we might have relatively little access to people from other backgrounds, relatively isolated communities or communities that, because of previous conflict, are relatively segregated. And especially in those environments, just knowing somebody who has an outgroup friend or an outgroup colleague can already change how you yourself also think and feel about that group.
What's the lesson then that we can take away if we're looking at expanding our circle of friends?
I would argue that it is one of the most effective things that you as an individual can do. So a lot of people are worried about the fact that our societies are becoming increasingly divided and polarized. But by engaging with people from another group, you as an individual can do something to change your own worldview, to make relationships between different groups that may otherwise be fraught more harmonious, to increase the diversity of views that you have access to, and ultimately also to benefit the people around you who may not themselves feel comfortable engaging with another group.
And would you argue we could be friends with anyone?
I think we can be friends with members of any group. Of course, there are additional factors that influence whether or not you feel attracted to somebody. So I don't think we can be friends with anyone, but I think there is the potential for us to get along with people from a whole variety of different groups who we may at first glance think that we don't have anything in common with.
On today's Personal Best, we're exploring the importance of friendships for our health, our happiness and our well-being. Psychologist Dr. Kirsty Miller is still with me. Kirsty, I guess with us living longer, we've probably got more chapters in our lives now. You think of school, maybe university, work, moving away to a different city or different country, maybe changing job, having kids, returning to work, retiring and then post-retirement life. That's a busy old life, isn't it?
Yeah.
I just wonder how much that has a bearing on the friends we make and keep.
I think we all need people who maybe know us. They've known us for a long time. They know our personality traits. They know how to deal with us, shall we say.
It's giving us that security, isn't it?
Exactly. That's it, exactly. And that's particularly useful in transition phases in our life. So things like becoming a parent, you know, if something negative happens or even just changing a job, it is useful to have these people who know you really well, perhaps friends from childhood, friends from college, university, people who do sort of know you well. Research has shown that having these sort of strong friendships, that can actually be really beneficial during life transitions. So it's some stability in our life. It's that sort of constant which we tend to lose during a life change. So it does help us in terms of keeping us a little bit grounded to our old life. And that has been beneficial, especially for people who maybe go through a life change because of illness, things like suffering a stroke or suffering a major life-changing illness.
Well, with that in mind, let's take a listen to Eric Sinclair, who's been sharing his own very personal thoughts on friendship.
Friendship is really important at times of crisis and stress, as I have discovered through my own experience of serious illness and bereavement. And I suppose the friends you can really count on are the ones that help to see you through these things. For example, I spent a long time in hospital as a result of illness, and it was interesting and encouraging to see those people who continued to come and visit me, even after several months had passed. And similarly, I suppose one can say the same about bereavement. You acquire a new identity as the bereaved person or the ill person, and this can make some friends very uncomfortable, to the extent that they may even avoid you. And I suppose the true friends are the one who can get over that particular hurdle and continue to maintain friendships with you.
Kirsty, I'm just thinking, listening to that and that idea of friends that you can rely on, it seems to be such a very basic human need, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. And that was very touching, wasn't it? And they all say that it's when you're in trouble that you know who your true friends are. And yes, it is something that in evolutionary terms, if you think back to sort of the beginning of mankind, it was very useful for us to have contacts. You know, we needed to have a little tribe almost, again, just for that sort of protection, both practical protection, so protection from predators, but also the emotional side of it as well. So having people who were there for you, it is a very basic human need that we do really need that human connection.
Just finally, we've been talking about friends and friendship and so on, but the idea of friendliness in our lives, I'm wondering how important it is for us to inject a bit more of that. I mean, I'm thinking of that simple nod or hello when you're walking down the street, or maybe getting to know new people on holiday. And does that even matter? Just some casual friendliness?
I think it does. Just having that positive interaction with someone, it does just give you a bit more of a spring in your step and just sort of puts a bit more of a positive slant on your day. And it's incredible how that just one pleasant interaction can then almost turn your mindset around. If someone said hello or you've had a little chat with someone, maybe even just at the supermarket, you then tend to be a little bit more friendly to someone you pass in the street. You know, you might be more likely to smile at them and so on and so on. It's a kind of knock-on effect. And obviously that sense of, I think it's a lot easier on holiday, isn't it? Because you tend to be more relaxed anyway and less caught up in your own mind.
So we need to inject a bit of that holiday feeling into our everyday lives.
Very much so,
yes.
So
when everyone's finished listening to this programme, you would advise the whole nation to get down the street, nod and say hello to each other.
And say hello, that's it. Just something as simple as that can make a huge difference.